We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 27, Jim Kay's Illustrated Harry Potter Editions. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Beatrice Groves and Emily Austin about the editions of Harry Potter that have been so beautifully illustrated by Jim Kay. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competence at Mount Carmel College of Nursing.
Today, we're looking at the Harry Potter editions illustrated by Jim Kay in expectation of Illustrated Book 5 coming out in October. So we're going to be discussing books 1 through 4 today, and we'll take some educated guesses about what we might see coming up in the new volume or what we hope is coming up in the new volume. Now, usually when we're talking about getting a visual representation of the Harry Potter books, Emily, we're talking about the films, which I think have done so much to cement in our minds certain images of the wizarding world. But Emily, what do you think about the whole idea of providing expanded visuals for the stories? Do you think it interferes with the reader's ability to create their own visual universe based on the text?
Well, in a word, yes.
I know that you try not to watch the movies at a certain point.
Yeah, at a certain point, I kind of gave them up like a bad habit. But that's a little different, though, because, you know, the movies not only interpret it visually for me and the audience, but they interpret it narratively as well. And so,
right, they make changes that
all of it.
Yeah, the changes hard to remember what's in the book and what's in the movie.
Well, and it's a more complete sensory experience, you know, than just a 2D, you know, visual on a page. So in that sense, I guess I love the illustrated editions, and I even loved the illustrated, the Mary Grand Pré illustrations.
Too.
Yeah. In the original books that I had. And so I really think those illustrations do a lot to help engage our imaginations. The Jim Kay ones are obviously more complete, but they still kind of fall short from what the films do in kind of embedding your senses in the story, and then also interpreting the story, you know, in a different way than really the books.
Yeah. And I think when you say fall short, you mean in a good way, in the sense that
exactly.
It can take over your brain.
Right.
And I sort of feel like, you know, the MuggleNet calendar that they sold for charity this past year was fan art of Harry Potter. And it was fan art that was very imaginative, and it wasn't, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, you know, portraits, and it wasn't, you know, Maggie Smith. So
right.
It was imaginations of the characters that were coming from the artists themselves. And that's my favorite kind of fan art. The
yes.
fan art that is, you know, that is depicting the person in a different way from what the actors were. And
right.
I think it's hard.
Yeah.
I think it's harder to do now.
Yeah, it is. It really stretches your mind to kind of encounter those characters in that new way. And yeah, mm-hmm. I do love that, because I like Harry Potter to me, in my mind, never looked like Daniel Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
And he still doesn't, you know. And so I enjoy kind of pushing back on that, on what the films, you know, ingrain in us
right.
by looking at other images. And so I especially appreciate these editions for that reason.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that Jim Kay commented on, which I didn't even ever think about this was he says that J.K. Rowling doesn't even have a lot of vivid description of the physical characters, you know, not too much.
Right. It's pretty
So
vague.
you do actually have a lot of space to create your own idea of what Snape looks like and what Hermione looks like and so on. And so I think it's wonderful to be able to re-engage with that.
Absolutely.
Well, great. Well, we are very pleased to have two guests joining us in our discussion today. We are delighted to have Beatrice Groves back with us on the show. Bea is a fellow and tutor at Trinity College, Oxford University, and author of the wonderful book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, which everyone should have on their bookshelf. She also writes for the MuggleNet blog, Batilda's Notebook, and there are all kinds of little treasures in there that Potter fans will enjoy, including some good Chim K treasures. So everybody wants to check that out. And you can find Bea on Twitter. Welcome back to the show, Bea.
Hi, Katie. Lovely to be here today.
We are also very pleased to have on the show for the first time Emily Austin, an artist and graphic designer working in watercolor, pen and ink, and digital media. She's passionate about exploring imagined worlds through visual art, and the works of J.R.R. Tolkien in particular have become a cornerstone of her creative output. Emily has also written about Middle-earth, Narnia, Harry Potter, and the works of George MacDonald while completing her master's degree at Signum University, where her thesis explored the motif of the road in The Lord of the Rings. You can find her at emilyaustindesign.com and on Etsy. I met Emily at MythMoot, which Signum University hosts. Wonderful event. And Emily, I bought one of your watercolors for my husband and he loved it. And I'm so excited to finally have you on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, I remember that. Thank you so much for buying some of my work.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful, just delightful. And I do love all, I just love illustration. I just find it, I like it just fully engages the imagination. I love to see what other people's images of, you know, Hobbiton are and so on. Let's just get right into our discussion about Jim Kay's illustrations. What do you think is the source of the appeal for Jim Kay's illustrations of the Harry Potter world? You know, why do we need this? Why do we want this in our world?
What I see in Kay's work that it is so appealing is, first of all, his sense of whimsy. I think it meshes really well with the text. It's very appealing. And I really love how much of a range he presents between very loosely drawn, emotional, evocative images, often of backgrounds, and then where he chooses to zoom in and show us very specific details. I think it creates a lot of rhythm in the illustrations, which then again just really leads you through the book in a wonderful way.
Yeah, I had noticed some of that too, that you never know what you're going to get when you turn to one of his illustrations. Sometimes there's a lot of detail, and sometimes he's got almost these kind of even abstract, inky, splashy things going on that are so, it's such an interesting combination. B, what do you think? What's the appeal?
I completely agree with Emily about the range and the whimsy, but I particularly love the Easter eggs, the sense of basically the way the illustrations echo exactly what Rowling is doing in her text, in leaving little clues and also personal ideas. So a lot of these are distinct to Kay. He's not, you know, there are things about the books, but there's also stuff that just he feels about. So, for example, he spoke about how once he saw a hare really close up and how that was an incredibly evocative moment for him. And he likes to therefore include a hare in all the books that he illustrates. And I think that's absolutely what Rowling does too, the way in which she has, you know, her birthday being an important place for her hero, her grandfathers being the names of the guys who write, who drive the night bus. It's the same attitude to this created world of being deeply personal. It is, I think it was Flaubert who said, you know, in order to be universal, you should be particular. And that's what I love about both of them, is that they are very particular to their own worlds, and yet that clearly has this universal appeal.
Yeah, how interesting. And I agree. I agree. I read some of his comments, and you can see that there are, you know, he's obviously a quirky person, and that fits so well the sensibility of these Harry Potter stories that are also quite quirky.
Yeah, absolutely. And he said how much, he said I was terrified of doing it, and that's sort of why I took it on, which is very brave of him. And clearly, it is a big issue if you're an artist to dedicate so many years of your life to somebody else's vision. And I think that has been difficult for him. But one aspect of that is that he's had to keep his own sense. So his own different attitude is present. And I thought it was a very nice link with Emily Austin's Tolkien love, which is, I don't know if you noticed this, Emily, that he said that he had Dumbledore. He wanted to have his Dumbledore as someone he really admired. And I love the fact he did that he made her
And he chose
into
an illustrator, didn't he?
that's right and the illustrator is he doesn't say in his interview who it is, but if you look at it is absolutely clear who it is. So it's John Howe, who's a Tolkien artist, and he's got identical eyes, so I'm sure it is him. And he says he's someone I absolutely idolize, and it's very clear if you look at Howe's illustrations that clearly Kay does idolize those illustrations. So, but I thought again that sense of the personal, Dumbledore should be someone for whom you feel that kind of admiration. So he's put his own personal admiration in the person he's made him into.
I believe he thanks John Howe in his acknowledgments.
Excellent. So it is clearly true. It's clearly him. But that's yeah. But he said it's very sweet. He says that a big deal for me that he lent his face to Dumbledore, which I thought was a very charming way of putting it.
The illustrations in these books are like part of the design of the books, and that's really attractive. You feel it's very immersive, and you feel like the illustrations are just, I mean, like there's a page, a couple of pages in Goblet of Fire that I'm sitting here leafing through it, and I just got to them, and it's after certain ones Emily has mentioned in the past have I was looking at the Black Mass, the scene at the end, when they're in the graveyard, and it's really scary. But in a couple pages after that, you've got Voldemort's big red eyes in the middle of the two pages, and it's really, you feel like you're in the story as you're reading the story, and it's just very immersive. So I love that. I feel like that's really appealing.
And how about when we have Lupin, the werewolf, and he's like over three separate turns of pages. You
Oh my
know, we
gosh.
have the wolf's body over several pages where it's describing that moment in The Prisoner of Azkaban, which I think is such a cool choice.
There's just so much to look at. It's like a feast for your eyes.
I thought a lot when I was looking through about how many meetings they must have had as a team, not just with Kay, but with, the book design team, and choosing which moments do we emphasize that way, and where do we leave more space for an illustration? What do we want to bring out? I think as you're going through any of the books, just looking to see where the book is giving a visual pause is often very significant.
That's they do one of the main ways they do that is with black pages, isn't it? Each book has got a section. So when you go underground, so in Chamber, when you go down to the Death Day party, it goes black. Azkaban, when you go to the Shrieking Shack, it goes black. So all those parts, Nocturne Alley, which is particularly nice because, of course, Nocturne Alley is a pun on nocturnally. So they all go black, and I think that's very well done. And I'm expecting we're going to see a lot more of that in Phoenix, given that sort of the blackness is the sort of overarching theme of that book. So I expect that's going to come back. But it does, it's, black pages with white text on them, you get the photo negative, which you don't get if you're just talking about blackness. You don't have to have that photo negative of the white text. So I think visually, black pages are very exciting and appealing, in a way that brings out sort of power of the darkness, not just its negative aspects.
And I think what Emily Austin was saying too about that there's this design element, and so some of the pages will have they'll have like a light design on the in the background, or little ink splashes, that are reminding you're in an illustrated edition somehow. And I think it does help to create, I don't know, it's a little bit like the wallpaper of the world that you're in, so that you remember that's where you are.
Jim Kay has said one of his favorite parts of illustrating it was the headnotes for each chapter. And of course, they kind of they're his own interpretation. I like that. So it fits in with, you know, marking off each chapter. So it fits in with the design aspect. But it also gives him a freedom of saying, what do I think the center of this chapter is? Or what came out to me in this? And I think that's very appealing. And it often picks up quirky aspects, like, you know, the wonderful illustration of the letter with Mrs. Weasley's put the stamps all over it. All the stamps. It's very appealing, and you can imagine that sort of a huge collection of stamps, and he's playing with all the stamps there. And you just think, yeah, it's a fun thing to pick out. And the same thing happens with characters. It enables him to pick on slightly sideline characters. So an example would be Parvati in the Boggart in the Wardrobe chapter. There's 8 pages of her spell. So her yellow spell, her ridiculous spell, is 8 pages of yellow. You see the sort of, you know, pale yellow comes up, and then you get her fantastically powerful spell, and then over the other page, the mummy being destroyed. And I thought, yeah, it's really nice he's picked Parvati as the one to illustrate there, and that, yeah, she gets to spread out. You know, it's just one little moment in the text, but she gets to spread out like that. And I think he's done the same with the cover of Phoenix. We've got Cho Chang's swan, Patronus, on that. And again, you know, you have to know your Harry Potter quite well to know what Cho's Patronus is. And I certainly saw people online who was like, who's this with the swan Patronus, you know? And I thought, yeah, it's great that he's picked her out. You know, she's not a major member of Dumbledore's army. You'd expect him to be having Harry, Ron, or, you know, Hermione more centrally there. And I thought that was really nice that he did that.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me, and you had mentioned this too, B, that he was like nervous to do these books. And he says he had not done a lot before he was commissioned for this enormous project. He has to work very hard at doing this. And he feels like it should be easier somehow. But he's going through like multiple versions of drawings, and he talks about drawings ending up in the bin.
I think this trial and error aspect works very well. On your point about lots of versions, the one of the pictures he said was his favorite was the header to chapter 7, The Sorting Hat, which has a lovely little picture of Hogwarts. And one of the things I really liked, he said it's his favorite for this very simple reason, just it came right first time. So I like that one. But it's a beautiful Elizabethan building. That's what I like it so much, is that he has put Hogwarts as an early modern building. Obviously, he's got lots of other little bits and pieces around, but I think the early modern period is where he's situating it mostly. And so you can really see that in this illustration, because it's got Elizabethan chimneys, you know, those lovely, tall, thick chimneys, and Elizabethan glass. And then he's also got sort of the H embossed in the stone, which happens in a number of Elizabethan buildings. Hardwick Hall is sort of one most famous one, where the Bess of Hardwick put her initials in stone at the top of Hardwick Hall, which just looks spectacular. And lots more hogs. So he's put his little hog, winged hog on it. They're great. And they're only mentioned once in the whole of Harry Potter. I don't remember, but it says there were winged hogs, sort of heraldic hogs standing on the gates into Hogwarts. And that's the only time the name is ever sort of made into canting heraldry. But it's really nice he's picked up on that, and they're everywhere in these books.
Yeah, and that's another example of how he picks up on the winged hogs at Hogwarts. Yeah. and then says, like, I'm drawing these.
They're going to be all around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another one, which again is on the same illustration, is acorns. He has acorns absolutely everywhere. And again, I feel like obviously that just fits very well with a sort of Englishness and his botanical side. But I also, Rowling does give oak as Hagrid's wand would. And she said, you know, it doesn't fit with where his wand would should be in the sort of Celtic tree calendar, which she used for others. But obviously Hagrid had to be oak. And he surrounds his illustration of Hagrid with acorns. So that sort of direct link with the wand would. But I feel like he's, again, just brought that out much more widely. I noticed just looking through the portrait of Ginny, she's got little acorns in the wool of her cardigan again,
Oh,
which I
neat.
thought was really nice. So I think you might have a general good guys have got acorns attached. So, you know, I like this.
Yeah, and I think, you were talking about how he liked the image that he had done of Hogwarts because it sort of came to him straight off, but I really appreciate that he is willing to restart, that he obviously does have the courage to just say, I'm going to restart this. And as an artist, I think that must be just very difficult. And for him to be able to do that, I think is very admirable.
You often are too close to your own work to really see what other people see when they look at it. And Kay also did, I believe it was a presentation for the college that he went to and did an art course. And he talked about how all illustrators hate their own work, or at least don't think it's as good as everyone else's. And that is definitely true. We all just feel like, why can't I do what so and so is doing? And so you sort of have to just get over that and just put your head down and work on what you're passionate about. But something that he talked about as well that I thought was fascinating in that same lecture was he likes to make models with paper or
Oh,
plasticine
yeah.
and create like these little 3D scenes, which he then can light in different ways or look at from different angles. So especially for like Hogwarts or for the Hogwarts Express, he has these little models which he can then, position where he wants. And I thought, oh, I want to try that. It sounds
Yeah.
very fascinating and just a wonderful way of getting a real tactile feel and being able to work out, how's the light going to hit this object at this time of day or whatever you need to do, you have that resource. So that was something that really stuck out to me, which I thought was immensely practical, but
Imagine.
also very fun.
And it does fit, doesn't it? I mean, I think his illustrations of both Hogwarts and the Hogwarts Express are particularly good. So I think it works.
Yes,
Yeah.
definitely works for him.
And I think it gives weight to the objects. They do have dimension and they seem like they take up space. And maybe that's because he's actually, he sees what it looks like in the space.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so much about art is understanding light. And so the more you can immerse yourself in how is light behaving in this scene and how do I get it to do what I want to do, I think the more successful your work is going to be, no matter what style you have.
Yeah, and he also mentioned that he had made models of some of the imaginary beings also as a way to, help them be born right from the
Yes.
imagination onto the page.
Yeah, I think he has a little Dobby and some other characters and creatures.
One of the things I love is the consistency of how the characters look and the creatures look across all the books. And I thought, like, that's really amazing ability to be consistent like that. And even as the children are aging, they still look like that version of Ron. And then he says he has models and they're getting older. And so he's able to use these children who are actually his models for the characters, which I thought was that's great. And again, personal,
Yeah, I think I can't remember, but is Hermione his niece or something like
Yeah, I
that?
think
She's
that's right.
and she's again particularly good. I think that first illustration of her lighting her little fire in front of the graffitied door is fantastic. And there's another great one in the Chamber of Secrets of her holding books and more sort of pen and ink one. And again, the feeling that he really likes this person comes through in her. The one in the graffitied door, I don't know if you noticed that, whether you had a look at the door, but he has real fun again with both his sort of personal history and that of the novels in that graffiti. It's got, one graffiti from older characters, so like Moody's graffiti did it in Riddle, and then he's put Rowling on as well. But he's also put things, I think his girlfriend is there, but also his own work. So He did the concept art for the BBC miniseries Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I don't know if any of you saw that. It was, yeah, really good.
Yes.
And Jonathan
Amazing.
Strange, of course, you know, they are wizards, so he's put Strange has graffitied that door, so he's been through Hogwarts, which I thought was a really fun idea. And I also noticed Stoker is there, as in Bram Stoker, which fits in with our earlier podcast about Dracula. So again, he just thought, yeah, of course Bram Stoker should have been to Hogwarts. So that kind of playfulness is so wonderful. And one of the things I actually really liked about the illustrations, but sort of how much writing he puts in, and brings his own ideas, you know, the own history of magic that Rowling has not always included. Obviously, she's so rooted in the history of magic generally, but he brings in things like, I don't know, like the Ouroboros, that are not actually in Harry Potter. And I think that's, yeah, I just love that. So I don't know if anyone noticed with the Boggart in the Wardrobe, what he's written on the top of that wardrobe. It's
No. Tell
yeah,
us, B, tell us.
it's a riddle called the Devil's Verse, which is an ancient Latin palindrome.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? I
Did you see
looked
that?
it up because I
Yeah.
saw it. I was like, what is
It's like,
this?
what is that? And I just love the fact it's called the Devil's Verse. So it's a palindrome, but it's also a riddle. And the riddle means we go into the circle at night and are consumed by the fire. And the answer to the riddle is generally considered to be a moth, sort of circles around the light and then is burnt. So I think, you know, he's mainly doing it just because palindromes, riddles, they fit so well with Rowling's world, and the Devil's Verse obviously fits beautifully with the sort of darkness. But I think also maybe there's this, you know, this is Azkaban, this is the Lupin book, the sort of attraction to the moth to the flame and Lupin to the moon fits quite nicely as well.
Yeah, and the whole closeted idea, you
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
and then the in the fire and you know being consumed. Yeah. Oh, there's a lot there's a lot to
And
unpack
he's
with
got a
that.
lovely one on the wall of the three broomsticks as well. It says in Latin, three makes company, which I think is really sweet.
Oh.
do you remember that in the film, Slughorn says, I remember it was just one broomstick. It's quite charming. And then as another, you know, I was talking about the Renaissance side to it, which I think we'll talk later. I think about the Holbein influence, so that's clearly another aspect of his Renaissance aesthetic. But there's a nice old English one with the snitch. So that's the header to chapter 11, Quidditch chapter in Philosopher's Stone. He puts a beautifully sort of steampunk
Yeah.
snitch there, and it says around the center of it, it's got an old English phrase which I don't know how to pronounce old English, but Mec Haec Werken, he called me to work, which I assume is a reference to sort of Bowman Wright, who creates the golden snitch in the Quidditch Through the Ages. But it's also very like the Alfred Jewel, and I you may know that, you know,
Oh,
obviously I'm
yeah.
in Oxford, Alfred Jewel is our sort of premier old English treasure, and that says on it, Alfred ordered me to be
Need to be
made.
made. Yeah.
So I feel, yeah, it's a little Alfred Jewel reference, a little old English moment, which is just, yeah, the idea that he puts that much work into it. And the words for the chapter 11 almost obliterate that bit of old English. It's very difficult to realize what it's saying. And to feel he's put that much work into something which almost nobody, one assumes, would actually work out, is wonderful, and is as I say, very much in Rowling's own métier of just putting so much effort in, not really thinking about how many people will work it out. You do it for yourself, and then their readers just love it.
B, I love the point that you made about how these visuals give a sort of a pause. And when there's writing in them, and they have all these little fun things to look at, and sometimes they're bringing in information from, like you mentioned, Quidditch Through the Ages or Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And so it gives you a chance to pause in the story and just like dwell in the world that's been built a little bit in a way that I just find wonderful. Because like that's my whole thing is I want to spend a lot of time in this world. And it gives me the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I think that's really nice, the sort of elusive to other texts. And I suppose also for those of us who are reading them, having already completed the series, you see things that take you to future books. So there's lots of Deathly Hallows symbols in book one, for example,
Yes.
which I thought was lovely because there is this circle between one and seven in the books themselves. So he's picking up on that. But I just wanted to say also, I have had friends with children who have found these a much more effective way into Harry Potter for, reluctant readers. They are working better in terms of being illustrated books. So I sort of forget that there's anyone in the world who doesn't want to read Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But there still are people for whom this is, it's
Well,
a lot of words.
yeah, B, this is my story because I, of course, I adore Harry Potter, and so, I've got three kids, and Hal was like a little tiny baby when I went to go see Rowling talk at Carnegie Hall, and she's talking to adults and answering questions for adults for the first time, and I left him as a little baby, and I thought, like, I'm gonna make him the biggest Harry Potter fan, and that's how I'll make up for leaving him while I go do this thing that I just really want to do. And he just couldn't get into it. I remember he was about six, and I open up the book and I start reading, and a page and a half in, it's all the owls and Vernon Dursley, and he says, "Why is this book so boring?" I was like,
Ouch.
sacrilege, how
Yeah.
dare you? And I
The
just went,
first chapter is the worst.
yeah,
I don't know how so many
yeah.
people have got over. I did give up the first time I read it. Just I don't like this chapter. And she said, it's the least popular thing I've ever written. It's amazing that millions of people have managed to get past
Managed to get
it.
past it. Yeah. And so what happened was that I could never get him to do it. And when he was about nine, I think I must have gotten this the first illustrated book. And I was like, all right, this is what I'm gonna do. And I moved the pages to it's the picture of Hagrid. And the text of it is the "You're a wizard" part. And I was like, Hal, I just want you to start here with this wonderful picture on this page. And he read it, and he read all the illustrated ones I had to that point. And then he was reading the books, and then he went back and read the first couple of
first bit.
books with just the text part. But he needed the illustrated one, and I actually even told this story to Jim Kay, and
Oh.
he had such a positive response. It was so nice
It's really
to hear
nice.
that from him, that he it means something, I would bet, to an
Absolutely.
illustrator.
Absolutely to know you're the way in. He said about that illustration of Hagrid that the reason it's from that perspective is because he thought it's good to remember a child's perspective. You're seeing Hagrid from Harry's point of view, and he's really towering above you. So that seems a particularly good place to enter a child into the text.
Well, it worked for us. So,
Yeah, I have
yeah.
to say, I think I read my son the books out loud before we had these editions, I think, or at least before we had as many as we have now. And it, Katie, it worked the same way. When he went back, I couldn't really interest him in reading the books on his own when he was, to that reading level. But the illustrated editions definitely sucked him in, sucked him right in. So then he
Absolutely.
went, and then he went and he read all the ones with illustrated editions that we had, which I think was only three. And then, but then he continued to blow through the whole series
Right.
just in like one summer, like the
Right.
summer before his third grade year or something like that.
Yeah, and my older son, Hal, he's very visual, like just very visual. And so I knew he would really be drawn in by these images. And so, yeah, that really worked. Well, let's talk a little bit just about what are some of our favorite images from the books? I think, we can already tell some of the ones that we're gravitating toward, but Emily Austin, do you have particular favorites?
Yes. Well, I did want to echo what B said about the pages with Parvati and the Boggart because that stuck out to me too. I think Azkaban may be it has a large concentration of some of my favorite pieces. And something else in that book, which I really love, are there are a few chapter heading pages that are very much like illuminated manuscripts. There's one
Ooh.
on 283, and it also has acorns and oak trees. It's got a beautiful moon, which looks like gold foil. of some sort. It's got some mountains, which to me look very Tolkienian. So just everything going on there, I love. There's also a wolf. It's a very
Ooh.
important chapter, and we talked about it being, things going dark. So it's one of those chapters where the text is white and the pages are dark.
In the same area, I just was really very moved by the way in Prisoner of Azkaban we have all of these dark pages with the white text, and it's about the lake, and the Dementors, and the Dementors are truly spooky. I mean, he has a macabre sensibility, Jim Kay. Lots of skeletal
Oh,
imagery that comes
yes.
through really strongly. And he does a lot
Definitely.
of these just inky black drawings where, I mean, he's just dealing in shades of black. I wouldn't even say gray. They're just, it's black and near black, and it's just very shadowy and dark. And then you get to Harry casting the Patronus, and it is this intense white, almost fluorescent. And the shape that comes out, and you can just see that it's a stag. And I just found it so moving and powerful, the Patronus coming out of all that darkness, that I even choked myself up a little bit, sort of watching it. And to me, that's my favorite moment in all the books. And so, to have it brought to life so emotionally in what Jim Kay does, I just thought it was so powerful.
I don't know if in that particular illustration he did another trick that he talked about, but it may be what a place that he did this. He talked about it specifically when creating the ghosts. He will often paint them and then invert the image digitally. And so all the colors become their complement. So if he'll paint something orange, it would become bright blue and vice versa. Or if you paint something very light, it will be dark. And so he'll do that and like sort of layer multiple images on top of each other for the ghosts. And I'm not sure whether he did that for the Patronus as well, but there certainly could be something of that sort going on in that image of the stag Patronus emerging, because it's very vibrant and then it's sticking out so starkly against the dark.
Right. Yeah. And the white, and as I turn to it, and as I'm looking at it, the blue, it feels like an intensification of the white somehow to me. I'm not really sure why that works, but yeah, he has all kinds of interesting techniques, like you say, that give you like color shocks that you don't expect, which is wonderful and surprising.
Yes, it's very
Yeah.
effective.
Other ones, B, do you have some
Yeah,
favorites?
one of my favorites is just thinking in terms of your color is when Harry enters into Riddle's diary in Chamber. I don't know if you remember that one. I thought that was
Yeah.
absolutely amazing. That's page 182. And how do you illustrate that? And I just thought he does this absolute swirl of color. And Emily will be able to tell us, but it looks to me like maybe he's painting on oil here, and the colors kind of smudge out, and so you just get a completely different effect from any of the other pictures, and that works brilliantly for this sort of visual traveling back in time, which is obviously very difficult to illustrate.
He talked about this in one of his interviews for the Chamber of Secrets, and he said what he did for the physical manifestation of magic that this illustration shows is he would actually throw powdered ink onto wet paper.
Ah, okay. So
So
similar feeling,
I
but
don't
yeah.
know exactly what type of ink he was using, but it seems pretty, what's
And
the
you
word
can
I'm
see
looking
that,
for?
yeah, but you can see that
Primal.
you can see, yeah, you get a powdered feeling from it, but also a wet, smudged feeling, which is a very
Yes.
complicated, and that works brilliantly. Ah, thank
So
you.
it's
That's,
very, yes, very pure color. It doesn't have those intermediary stages of it. Oh, well, it became paint and then it was transferred, from the brush to the,
Yeah.
it was pure color and then it went straight to the page.
Oh, fantastic. Another very different style, but I suppose my other favorite one is probably the Albus Dumbledore portrait from the first book, which is just straight Holbein. It's so, I mean, he has said in an interview it's Holbein, but you don't need him to say that because you've got just the color and the portrait, but also the way he writes, Albus Dumbledore
Right.
gold against the back. So you've
Writing
got
the
this sort of
name on the back. Yeah.
exactly the realism of it, but then also just write, and Holbein's up, I find Holbein such a realist. For me, I feel like I know these people. It's so powerful, his portraiture. But then he writes their name in gold on the background, so you get this sort of alienation from the realism alongside. But one of the things that Kay said he really likes about Holbein is the way in which all the objects that surround his sitters have symbolic meaning. And again, this is something obviously Rowling does. All the names, all the objects are symbolic, and so it's a lovely sort of three-way triangle between Holbein, Kay, and Rowling, all doing this kind of style. And this one, he's got the honesty, so it's got a dried honesty flower, and he said, "I do think of Dumbledore as very honest, but he's put a praying mantis in there." Mantis, he was saying, partly he was using the fact that mantis comes from same word as mantic. It's a prophetic word, so it wasn't entirely negative, but obviously has those negative connotations of sort of there's sort of danger in his honesty. He's not actually telling you everything. So I thought that was a very nice sort of double image there. The Latin for honesty is albus. It's an alba something. It's a white flower, so that's really nice. But something that's very witty about this, and I thought maybe we should talk a bit about the wit of his illustrations as well, is the way in which he puts the sherbet lemons into
Right.
Albus's hands here. And
And the
if you look
knitting
at,
needles. He's
and the
got
knitting,
knitting.
yeah, it's lovely. But in Holbein portraits, people often have a really important thing in their hand. So, for example, in his portrait of Erasmus, obviously Erasmus is holding his translation of the Bible. He's looking very pleased with himself about the fact that he's done this amazing thing. And that one is linked to directly with Snape's portrait, which again is a Holbein influence. And in fact, he has Erasmus's expression in that as well. But he's holding the Half-Blood Prince, the potions textbook. So just like Erasmus has, translated his one, and Snape sort of translated the book he's holding. And that was fun. I saw that in the History of Magic exhibition, because in the illustration in the book, you can't actually, I think, really see the HBP that's written on the spine. It's not clear, but in the original painting, which I saw in the exhibition, you can see very clearly that it has that. And Snape has all these symbolic objects. He has Lily of the Valley for his love for Lily. He's
Oh,
got
what about the mole in the
a
jar?
mole, I think,
That.
is meant to be a sign of his being an underground, i.e., a double agent.
Yeah, he is literally a mole.
Yeah,
I
exactly. He's a
guess that's
mole in
right.
the other sense. Yeah. And
Right,
again, it's really
right.
nice because, like we have that with Skeeter being literally a bug. So you have that. He sort of brought that out with the mole. The scissors, which are in that portrait, again, loads of Holbein's portraits have got scissors. His Cromwell has got scissors. And I feel like just like with the Cromwell, where the scissors are sort of meant to be the fact that Cromwell is sort of in charge and he's, affairs of state. I feel like maybe cutting the ribbons off, letters and things that he's in charge, but also the Sectum Sempera spell, the cutting spell, the sense of, the sort of danger of Snape, but then the two halves of him sort of coming together and working. So with the Snape portrait, he has all this, really symbolic stuff. And then the sherbet lemons, I think, are just a sort of funny, instead of having Erasmus's Bible, we've got sherbet lemons in his hands. I think, brings out, it's like the Brian in Dumbledore's name, it's the comic bit
The
that
humor, yeah.
works so nicely. Yeah. And he does have lots of funny illustrations. I thought my favorite other one was the snakes and ladders. I don't know if you noticed that with the sort of first, one of the earliest ones in Philosopher's Stone, when the snake comes out at the zoo, shopkeepers dropped a ladder at the same time and it's a tiled floor. So suddenly you've got a snakes and ladders game in
Oh,
the
I didn't see that, but that's clever.
illustration. And there's so many, again, just picking up, there's so many game metaphors going on in Harry Potter. We had a podcast, didn't we, about chess and tarot and these sort of ideas of game in the past. So
Yes.
again, I felt he's doing his own one. There are no snakes and ladders games in Harry Potter,
Yeah.
but with his with it, yeah, keep in keeping with what she's doing.
Yeah, he does some beautiful little These are ones that they pop up in the middle of text, little chess pieces who have various expressions
Yes.
on their faces, which
Yes,
is
and
so fun.
those are the Lewis chessmen. So did you know the Lewis chessmen? They're these incredibly famous Scottish chessmen. They're very old. And they were discovered in Lewis, I think, when there was a storm and the sand came back. And yeah, so they are regularly voted the most important thing in the British Museum, the Lewis chessmen. And that's, yeah, so it's a really nice, again, it's a really nice Scottish reference for Hogwarts being in Scotland, that the chessmen should be the Lewis chessmen.
Okay, can I just add to the our favorites?
Yes, please do.
Because guys, Dobby is so cute
Oh, I
in
love the nose.
he's so adorable and the big humongous eyes, and then you get a little butt flash of Dobby running down the stairs. It's the cutest thing in the world. I remember being scandalized by it when I first saw it, but then I was like, "Oh, it's so cute. Look at him." But of course, he's only wearing a tea or a
A tea
pillowcase
towel.
or a tea towel, whatever it is, So of course, you're going to get some butt flashes with Dobby. That's just realistic, given his choice of wardrobe,
Winky gets a little picture as well, and poor sad Winky with her bottle of butter beer dangling from her fingers. Aw.
I noticed that there are fewer sort of like backgrounds in the Goblet of Fire. It's a bit more streamlined as far as choosing moments to illustrate, and then the pages with text are more just text. There's a little bit of like a texture behind them, but it's not quite as, ink splots everywhere, or not quite as many little tiny illustrations melding in. And I wonder if that's just sort of the practical reason of a bigger book, and it needs to be a bit more carefully chosen.
I can only imagine like the enormous amount of time and energy it takes to produce all these, amazing works of art for these books. The one that is one that's really my favorite. I love the Patronus one I described, but I love Diagon Alley. And he brings us into different parts of Diagon Alley in different, in a bunch of different pictures. And I love the sheer detail. I mean, he's got all the stores and stores we've never heard of.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that as well. Yeah, these, and
And
again,
funny, there's a pub called the Three Sheets, which I like. I assume it's a pub.
there's Janus Galloglass selling scrying mirrors as well. You've noticed
Oh,
that one.
yeah.
So again, that's a sort of Galloglass is really fun because it doesn't mean mirrors at all. It's a name for warriors. So it's just taking this word that just sounds like it works for mirrors and take it. So again, that's just that creativity with language that he's got. But I also really like the Janus again as an Easter egg, because obviously Janus is the god with the heads, basically a face on the
Oh
back of
yeah, the
his
two
head. So he's
faces.
a yeah,
Perfect.
so he's a Quirrell sort of joke, but also Quirrell's own name. So Quirinus Quirrell, there is a Janus Quirinus. So she's put that Janus reference into Quirrell's own name, sort of quite a subtle way. And I thought, yeah, again, he's picked up on that and put it in Diagon Alley.
The movie Diagon Alley, wonderful. And of course they recreate it in the theme park. Wonderful. Of course, I would totally love to be there. However, I'm just going to say I find it a little bougie in the sense that I think it's a little upper scale than what I had imagined Diagon Alley would be. And when I look at Jim Kay's Diagon Alley, I'm like, now that's a Diagon Alley. There are some like rundown hoarder's paradise stores.
Yeah, you feel like you're almost in danger just walking down the street because the houses may tumble down on you.
Yeah, and there's some kind of yeah, they're just so densely packed with things, and it's kind of scruffy and grubby, and it's not all polished, and it looks old. I really, of course, I love the things that are kind of old, and I love that whole sensibility that comes through, where you think you might stumble upon some little wonderful old but decrepit looking object. I think about these people, like American pickers who go through They're going through hoards and they find amazing treasures. And I feel like that's what you're being invited into in these Diagon Alley pictures.
Very lived in.
Yeah. And you just
And
think of
so
the time and energy it takes to actually put those. I mean, how much time must he have spent,
there's
you
so
know?
much detail, so much
Right.
detail. Really, I love any of his cityscapes, even the ones that are
Oh,
less
yeah.
detailed, that when they, especially when they run just like at the bottom of the page and they're just there creating a mood, for,
Right, the
for
outline
what
of
you're reading.
London.
Yeah,
Yeah.
just
Yes.
gorgeous.
And he's got another lovely, the flourish and blots, which is again, I like the fact that that's the biggest,
Yeah.
is another Elizabethan building, with some sort of Tudor beaming and Elizabethan chimneys. And next door to that, I don't know if you notice, there's a little boat with a telescope on it, which I think it must be a reference to Mary Poppins. With the boat on the top, so that's quite a fun little, again, just
That's
sort of
lovely.
children's literature and culture reference.
I think he mentioned in one interview that he took note of the street numbers for each, or the address number for different stores, and thought, well, there's got to be something in between these that they are walking past. And that was sort of
That's really
the
fun. So that's why,
inspiration
yes, to
behind
having all the
adding.
extra.
Yes.
That's good.
Well,
And it's also, yeah, it's true that in the books there aren't quite enough. It's like they're not quite enough shops generally in terms of how long that, Harry's there for sort of 2 weeks, isn't it, one stage? Surely he'd be going to a lot more shops than this. So yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, and one of the things when I was looking at Diagon Alley, I was thinking, the way I like this is the way I like the Richard Scarry books, which have the same like packed in details, and you're always like you're looking at the page, you're brought in to like what's happening over here in this house, you know? And then I noticed that he actually said he was inspired by Richard Scarry and some of his images. So that's one of his influences too. Are there, so we've talked about Hans Holbein and there's Richard Scarry. Are there other influences that you all see?
I find his work very reminiscent of Norman Rockwell and some of the other Golden
Oh.
Age illustrators, especially in facial expressions. Rockwell is very known for that, and having just these wonderful, different, very real looking people. They're not perfect. They're human. And I think that Kay really picks up on that. Someone else I thought of was Arthur Rackham, who often has these lovely tree, twisted roots, all sorts of natural illustrations with a lot of kind of personalization added into them. Coincidentally,
Yeah.
he was probably an inspiration for Tolkien, for some of his, like for the Ents. Tolkien references Rackham, and Kay does a little bit of the same, like these twisty roots and things in some of his pieces.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think I really see Rackham here. This is a tiny one. There's just one illustration that's this guy, but I don't know if anyone else has read the children's picture book, The Lighthouse Keeper's Lunch.
I have
It's,
not, but it will be
oh,
on
well,
my
I
list.
totally recommend it. If you have a
Yeah.
small person to buy a picture book for, it is absolutely charming. And the bit at the very beginning where Vernon Dursley is going out to the little island on his, with his in his boat is definitely straight homage to The Lighthouse Keeper's Lunch, which is by David Armitage. But I thought, again, just a lovely little children's illustration allusion, which is so nice to see.
Yeah, and I think, Emily Austin, you brought up the botanical aspects of Jim Kay's drawings, and he does a lot with plant life. And B, you also were talking about some of the symbols that he's bringing in, and he does insects also, right? He's got this kind of natural. He's interested in nature, and I think that's why we get some of these, big foldouts that are, the phoenix, or I love the troll one, which I find so amusing. He's got the troll brain, which
And
is
he
I'm
also
just it's so funny. But you've got this kind of nature and botanical influence. So that's I think something that's operating him on him as well.
And I really like the way in which he makes Hogwarts so intertwined with nature. So he has it standing on trees. It's always, obviously in the greenhouses, the plants are all kind of breaking out through the glass. But even Hogwarts itself, sort of I think the end of Azkaban, where you just have a final picture of the walls and the plants are everywhere and a peacock's nesting on the wall and all that sense of this built environment being absolutely entwined with the natural one.
I do love the herbology greenhouse. It's just gorgeous. And he actually puts that in a few times, I think, because he must love it.
Yeah,
He
and does
did.
it always
He.
look the same though? Because it feels like it looks maybe different.
No, I think that's why it is a bit different, but he worked at Kew Gardens,
Yes.
and they're definitely based on that idea, aren't they? But I agree, they sort of move around a bit. But yeah, there are lots of different greenhouses after all, so
Yeah, I think he
Right.
specifically
one each time.
said he was, showing different ones, and they get a bit crazier as you move up from one, two, three.
Yeah, I noticed that. I enjoy that. It's almost like, yeah, this kind of natural evolution.
Well, one of the I talk about this artist in my European feminism course because she's a very early scientific artist, Maria Sibylla Marion, who does these gorgeous images. I guess she traveled like to South America, and she does this beautiful image of a, the caterpillar, going into a cocoon and then coming out a butterfly. And I see that. I'm not sure if he's particularly influenced by her, but he said he actually, I mean, who was like the curator, I guess, of the botanical drawings and so on at Kew Gardens. And so I wonder if, he was influenced by those kinds of almost scientific, but gorgeously drawn views of nature and natural processes.
Oh, you definitely see that in the illustrations.
After you mentioned her name, I noticed I was going through the History of Magic exhibition
Yeah.
catalog book today, and she actually has a piece, like they feature one of her spider illustrations
Oh.
next to Kay's spider, the huge Aragog illustration. So at least the curators of the exhibition were
Right.
thinking along those lines. And I remember Kay also mentioning, especially for like the Mandrake illustrations, that he was sort of channeling Da Vinci in those and thinking of all his anatomical drawings. So there's definitely a lovely mishmash of all those different inspirations playing through.
Yeah, and I think that all of that, to me, it gives the whole thing a feeling of like deep history. Like there's a real world and a culture that's multi-layered. B, you were talking about the Elizabethan architecture, and then we have all of these influences from artists of the past, and the sense of ancientness in a lot of the images that he brings up. And I think that contributes to the deepening of the world building that I think is so cool in the Harry Potter stories.
I do have one other Easter egg that is my
Okay.
personal favorite in Goblet of Fire. There's an illustration of Ron's bookshelf near the beginning of the book, and he's got his Quidditch books and such, and all his Chudley Cannon's memorabilia. But there's also Tolkien's monogram on one of the books, so Ron has something published by either Tolkien or Christopher Tolkien on his bookshelf. I like to think it's maybe Unfinished Tales or something like that, because
Oh,
I'm not sure
yeah.
if he pulled from a specific spine or if he just put the monogram there, but it looks exactly like some of the like HarperCollins, 80s and 90s published pieces.
Kay did mention that he had a lot more time for Goblet and did put a lot more Easter eggs in that one.
That makes
And
sense.
I know one I liked was the fact that Rita Skeeter's handbag has a scarab beetle as the clasp, which again I thought was really fun because it fits with the beetle idea, but he's got his own take on it. He's chosen a scarab beetle to link in with his own interests, a number of sort of other Egyptian and ancient art aspects, like the way the hippogriffs look like Mesopotamian creatures and that sort of thing. So that fits very nicely with that, I thought.
Yeah, really neat. And I love the intertextuality, and I'm not sure what you call that in the realm of illustration, but that there are all these references that are identifiable, and we can see it's just very clever. And again, it like the books reward rereading, the illustrated versions reward, relooking at the images, which
Oh,
I think is so I
yeah.
appreciate.
You could look at these all day. Literally, I've been sitting
Yeah.
here thumbing through them as we talked, and that may be why I've been quiet because I'm just completely absorbed in looking at these books. There's
Well,
so much to look at.
I know, and I think I'm just struck by how surprising the variety is, and I never know what I'm in for on the next page. These illustrations, they often present a unique perspective on a particular scene. There might be an unusual viewing angle. We've talked a little bit about these, or an unexpected close-up. I sort of feel like a lot of times the characters are almost like leaping off the page at you, Crookshanks chasing Scabbers, or flying broomsticks or what have you. So there's a lot of movement, but then sometimes it's a real pulled back image capturing atmosphere or the setting. So what effect does all of that, these different perspectives have on the reader or the viewer as we're reading through the story?
Well, I think it helps make you feel like you're in the story, because if you're really in a place, you're going to notice things all around you rather than like the main action. So I think some of the ways he diverts attention sort of adds to the feel of the world and that you're really there. That's definitely one effect that I see happening.
And I think he has a different perspective in another way as well, doesn't he? He picks up unusual aspects or small lines, and follows those through. So that's quite nice in terms of encouraging the reader to find their own parts of the books that speak to them. One of those that I really liked was there's a moment where Ron and Mrs. Weasley are reading over Ron's book list together. And that's not mentioned in the text that they do that, but you see this little moment of shared maternal attention.
I
And I
know, I
think
love
what
that picture.
it was a beautiful one, isn't it? And it fits with the line where we're so used to the idea that Ron is jealous of Harry, and we get the line there where Harry is jealous of Ron, and it fits absolutely with that this maternal affection, which Harry has been without, is so obviously it's so important to the books generally. But I think it's really lovely to give Ron and Mrs. Weasley that little moment together.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that I think about also are the choices that Jim Kay has made that really strike me as quite different from, say, what the movies have done. And I actually was really struck by Mad-Eye Moody and how Mad-Eye Moody, to me, like there's a whole different just a feel from that particular character, and that I thought, I mean, again, kind of like creepy and definitely pretty scary fellow. And not to say that doesn't come through in the films, but there's I don't know, he's a little hardier or something in the film than what you see in Jim Kay's illustrations. Are there other, sort of divergent choices that he's made that you all find interesting?
I'm not sure if it's terribly divergent, but I love the way he draws Draco Malfoy because it's very consistent with what is described in the book, but I don't think it really looks much at all like the actor Tom Felton. And he just, there's something about the blue gaze that he, it's very pale blue and it's very privileged.
He
And he
puts
ca
rings under his eyes too.
yes
There's a
yes
hollowed out look or something that he
yes he's
has.
lit he's lit him from below, which is always
Oh.
very creepy. And I believe Kay also mentioned that he tried to make his face just a little bit too symmetrical, because no human face is perfectly symmetrical. So if you just make it just a little bit too balanced, it
Yeah.
gives you that sense of, oh, there's something weird going on here.
Yeah, it's all that good breeding.
That
Quote
is
unquote, good
funny
breeding.
because Rowling has that in her strike books. So the sort of handsome baddie Matthew, who is the person who Robin is married to primarily, as far as I can see, just because he's very good looking. And it says his face is so symmetrical that his face is identical in the mirror to reality. So
Mm-hmm.
that's a really nice, yeah, link between the too symmetrical is suspicious.
Yeah.
I really like where he has that first portrait of Malfoy, that he uses the fact that he's got the measuring tape to give him a little snaky
Yeah.
Slytherin motto. That was very clever.
Yeah, I could definitely see S Slytherin right away. So when we think about book five, and the challenges of book five, what do you think are some of the challenges? And then also, what are you really looking forward to, to seeing Jim K. illustrate out of book five?
Well, the challenges of Goblet of Fire would certainly extend and grow in Order of the Phoenix, just paring down what do you illustrate and how do you reduce it to just the pure essential, what do you want to draw attention to? What do you want to emphasize? But I'm personally looking forward to seeing Tonks. I think she's probably
Oh,
my
yeah.
top, what I look forward to. And there hasn't been a terrible amount of Sirius.
Oh, that's
I
true.
don't know. Has there been like an official portrait of him? I don't remember if there was one in Goblet of Fire. In Azkaban, he's mostly just in those like dramatic scenes where you don't know he's good yet.
Yeah,
Yeah, exactly.
I
So
bet
we only
he's.
get bad Sirius, don't we? Get Sirius looking terrifying in
Yeah,
Shrieking Shack,
I bet we
just.
do get a portrait because I bet he's saving that for five.
Parallel Lupin. No, I agree. And it would be really nice to see Grimmauld Place. I think that'll be the new sort
Oh,
of
yeah.
spooky place.
And with lots of little stuff in it, right? I mean, that's the whole thing about Grimmauld Place. There should be lots of Richard Scarry type detail.
Yeah, like Horcruxes just lying about.
Exactly. So how's he going to draw those out? I bet we'll have that scene and we'll see the locket Horcrux sort of glowing slightly as they put it away. As with Emily's point about Tonks, obviously it'd be great to see Luna. I hope we get a
Oh,
portrait of
yeah.
her.
And
Oh
Thestrals,
yes.
right?
Oh,
Yeah.
Thestrals will be
Yeah.
great.
Maybe we'll get
So
like a
Kay,
page on Thestrals.
we're gonna get lots because Kay said that's what he's most looking forward to in illustrating Phoenix is Thestrals. And
Oh, cool. Makes
so yeah, we're
sense.
definitely gonna, I think we're gonna see the Thestral ride across London.
Yeah, it's skeletons and it's nature. It's like the perfect combo.
Exactly.
All the
That's
things.
yeah, I was so right. That's why they've spoken to him. So I think
Yeah.
also, I don't know if he's gonna do them completely solid. You'd have an option of having that sense that half the people can't see them. Yeah, it could be interesting,
Yeah,
couldn't it? Doing
has the
what
option
the
of
reader, yeah, the reader
treating
can't
them
see them or can see them.
like sort of like the ghosts, where he does like a composite image, or he could go more like the Dementor route, where there's these flowing watercolor, extensions to the form, and it just sort of melds back into the background. Or yeah, he could go a lot of different ways with the Thestrals, or you can do the very detailed, more scientific drawing. So maybe he'll do more than one.
Yeah, well,
Will.
if he's excited to do it, like he could do a bunch.
Yes.
We would look at all of it. Yeah, of course, I'm interested in Umbridge. Like, I think there's got to be some good Umbridge stuff in here. And the ministry,
Kittens, kitten plates.
right?
Yes, please.
And the Ministry of Magic also, I think, and especially, the trial room. And I think one of the things I think is a challenge for the Order of the Phoenix is it's such a dark book. And I even think about the original cover of the book. It's like it's the blue and the black, and it's quite dark. And I wonder if he will keep a lot of the images dark. I mean, Goblet of Fire has lots of, with the Quidditch match and and the different Triwizard events, there are opportunities for, like sunshine and fresh air. And I there's some things like that in Order of the Phoenix, but not much. It's all kind of, think about Grimmauld Place and the, Harry on trial at the ministry, and then, the forest. And oh, I guess there's Grop. We maybe have Grop to look forward to as well. But
Maybe the room of requirement will be very bright.
yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so I'm interested, where's he going to bring in the lighter elements? Yeah, room of requirement. Ah, yeah, that'd be cool to
It
see.
is sort of like a refuge for the students, so it would be wonderful if it was a visual refuge as well.
Yeah, so I guess we're all looking forward to all of these you know, all of these new elements that come in with Order of the Phoenix. And you know, maybe we should try to get gather together again after we've had a chance to look at the Order of the Phoenix and come back and have another conversation.
That'd be
Shall I be
great.
game
Yeah,
for that?
we look forward to
Yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, a little follow-up. Wonderful. Well, thanks so much, Emily and B, for joining us on the show today. What a great conversation. We here at Potterversity have just received some late-breaking news. Jim Kay has announced that he has made the decision to step away from the Harry Potter series to focus on his mental health. The fifth book will still be published and released as planned and will be full of Jim's wonderful work, but future books will be handed over to another artist. From the team here at Potterversity, and on behalf of all of our listeners, we would like to extend Jim our best wishes and thank him for the amazing, imaginative, and beautiful legacy he has given to us as fans. Thank you, Jim. We are going to close today with a quote. It's a quote about the enchanting wonder and power of art, and so I couldn't resist choosing it for this episode. Luna had decorated her bedroom ceiling with five beautifully painted faces: Harry, Ron, Hermione, Ginny, and Neville. They were not moving as the portraits at Hogwarts moved, but there was a certain magic about them all the same. Harry thought they breathed. What appeared to be fine golden chains wove around the pictures, linking them together, but after examining them for a minute or so, Harry realized that the chains were actually one word, repeated 1,000 times in gold ink. Friends, friends, friends. Listeners, may your world be filled with magic, with art, and with friends, friends, friends.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.